I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm Ann Stickney, one of two lore-focused writers for Blizzard Watch, and I've got both of my wonderful co-hosts with me today. First up, he's a shaman columnist. He's also a lore aficionado. That would be Joe Perez. Hey, Joe, how's it going?
It's going real well. Yesterday was a very important day for me.
What happened?
That was the big charity event.
How'd that go?
Really, really well. I can't disclose exact numbers, but we raised a good portion of money, a good portion of food donations that came in. I think we're still counting cans. It was just really, really good. Everybody had a really good time. And we did a couple of new things this year. Like we did a charity auction instead of just a blind raffle for everything that we got, because we get a bunch of prize support from various companies to raffle off and, you know, for proceeds to go through everything. But I did a custom bust with a custom plinth as my donation to the auction, and it went really, really well. It sold really, really well. So I'm super excited, which now means that next year moving forward, we can be a little bit bigger, a little bit bolder, and see what we can do to sort of expand it out, which I'm super excited for.
So this is kind of an annual thing for you guys.
It is. It has been an annual thing for me, at least. I've been part of it for the last 5 years. This is the first year that we actually established a base organization, though, so that we can do more beyond this one event and actually receive, you know, legally donations and stuff like that outside of the normal cycle, which is working out real well. But it is an annual event, the big one. So if anybody happens to find their way in the Western New York area at the same time next year, y'all are welcome to come by and, you know, make sure you follow me on Twitter, and I'll tweet things out as they come out. And, you know, not to plug myself, but it's LoaderZJ, LoaderZJ on Twitter. And, you know, if you're interested in charity events and gaming and feeding the hungry, well, yeah, I'll make sure any events we get are posted there.
Hit us up with the name of the charity one more time.
The charity's name is Roll for Charity, R-O-L-L for Charity. So, you know, place, rolling. It makes sense. Good.
Cool. Thank you, Joe. And also with us today is our other lore-focused writer over on Blizzard Watch. That would be Matt Rossi. Hey, Rossi.
Hey, everybody.
You had a birthday.
I did indeed. I am older, yet still sure. Older. Here's an idea of how old I am. I wasn't 40 yet when Cataclysm dropped 8 years ago on my birthday. That's right.
Okay.
It's been 8 years since Cataclysm came out, and I have since crossed over. I'm now 47.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yep. Think about how that feels, guys. 47 years old. The game is 14.
It's still one of the best tanks in the game. Anyway, happy birthday. A little bit late.
Yeah, we did the podcast recording 2 days before.
Yeah.
And then we're doing this podcast 2 days after. So it's like we're circling it.
Yeah. Well, that's how it usually is with mine. It was just this year, for whatever reason, it landed right on my birthday, which was kind of cool. So, all right. So this week, Patch 8.1 is coming out on Tuesday, and there's going to be all kinds of lore stuff to talk about in regards to that. However, it's not out yet. So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and go back to the mailbag because we have so many emails, and we're going to try and hammer our way through some more of those and probably end up on a tangent somewhere because that's just what we do. If you have an email for the show or you have a question for the show, excuse me, you can email that to podcast@blizzardwatch.com and be sure to put Lorewatch in the subject line so that we know that it's intended for this show. Just so you know, in 2 weeks we will be talking about 8.1 in detail, so if you have any questions that pop up between now and then about the lore of 8.1 or any of the story elements that were presented in 8.1, please feel free to hit us up because that's what we're going to be talking about. All right. So first email here is actually, it's regarding the novel Before the Storm. You guys have both read that, right?
Oh yeah. Yep.
Okay. Multiple times.
Okay. All right. And this one is from Holy, who is a prot pally from Thrall, who says, "Hey guys, this question is very simple, but you can expand upon it. Are Safi and Grezik from Before the Storm, are they dead? When they got captured, did they make an escape? If you think so, why? If you don't think so, why not?" Without going into too much detail, I think we can safely say that they're alive. And I'm not going to go into much more detail than that. But they are. They did escape. For people that are wondering who that is exactly, Grezik is a goblin from Before the Storm, and Safi is a gnome from Before the Storm, and they've got kind of a hate-love relationship, sort of, I guess.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, it's not quite love-hate, it's more like hate-love, like, it's a pretty great relationship that they've got. They are featured throughout the book. They're kind of like one of the side stories that's going on there because obviously Sylvanas is very interested in the Azurite and so is Gallywix. Grezik is an inventor and probably one of the more ingenious inventors, and they tap him. He's supposedly quote-unquote retired, but they go and they tap him to work on and develop Azurite stuff. And in exchange, he asks them to find Safi for him. And she's about as happy about that as you'd expect. But yeah, it's kind of one of the side things from Before the Storm. If you haven't read the book, I really suggest that you read it. Characters and situations from that book are apt to come back into play throughout the course of the expansion. So it's one of those things that, yeah, you probably want to read it. Anyway, Holy, that's all I'm going to say about it, really, is yes, and you'll find out more later.
But it's very likely we will probably find out something when we have that huge thing about goblins and gnomes that drops in the middle of patch 8.2.
If they don't feature in that, I don't know what's going on. Anyway, next email. This is from Halfric Runefist, who's a human paladin on Moonguard, who says, "Hello, Watchers. My question has to deal with Bane and how the Tauren fit with the Horde. Of all the Horde races, the Tauren seem to fit less and less with the dynamic of the Horde and its actions. The gentle and peace-loving giants are constantly dragged into unnecessary wars and committing terrible things in the name of warchiefs that see them as nothing but muscle to be thrown at the enemy. It seems like Bane is almost always saying what the Horde is doing is wrong, but he's so easily cowed, pun not intended. Anyway, my question is, do you think that Bane is a coward for not standing up for his beliefs? He always has a problem with how the Horde operates, but has never actually put his hoof down and said enough is enough. If he actually decided to say, leave the Horde, Anduin would for sure back him up and the Tauren would fit with the Alliance ideals far better than the Horde's, wouldn't they? Death to the Lich Queen, because this is just such a cheerful email. Alfred Runefist, human paladin, Moonguard.
I'm going to be upfront. I do not agree with the preference of this at all.
Okay, well, let's talk about Bane. Let's talk about Bane. Yeah. You go ahead, Rossi.
If you read War Games, there's a point where Sylvanas and Bane get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And Sylvanas realizes that if he wanted to, Bane could squash her like a bug. He's so physically powerful, he could have her literally a flat stain on the ground before she could move. He could snap the bones in her arms with a gesture. It's not cowardice, it's forbearance. Tauren control themselves a lot because when they are truly angry, Like, if you go back and you look again to before War Crimes, even you go back to the Shattering novel, when Cairn finally gets into it with Garrosh, Cairn starts to lose his temper. Cairn forces himself to calm down, but he accepts the Mac-Gora and he doesn't hold back. And he's winning the Mac-Gora. He's beating Garrosh Hellscream. He is an old, old Tauren at the time. They call him the old
Magatha,
bull.
Or Magatha, I guess is how they're pronouncing it. Anyway, if she hadn't intervened, Garrosh would probably be a flat stain somewhere in the Orgrimmar arena.
And again, he was an old bull. He was not in his prime. He was not at the peak of his powers. And he was beating Garrosh Hellscream in a fight. Tauren control themselves. It doesn't mean that he's cowardly or weak. It means that he thinks very deeply about what he's going to do. And keep in mind, Bane has an example in his own history of going off half-cocked and it blowing up in his face. Bane got captured by harpies because he decided he could handle an entire village of them by himself, and he was only slightly wrong. Like, he's learned, I can't jump too quickly. I have to really think about what I'm doing. But cowardice, no. And the idea that they align more with the Alliance, no. Absolutely not. The Horde are the ones who actually helped the Tauren. Tauren were like basically fighting an enemy that wouldn't stand and fight them. The Centaur wouldn't stand and fight the Tauren. They ran in, burned supplies, stole supplies, and ran out. Hit and run harassment tactics, which they were very good at because they're half horse. You know, they can get away from you pretty easily. The Tauren couldn't catch them to bring their superior strength to bear. And keep in mind, I'm saying the Tauren are stronger than somebody who weighs about 1500 pounds because they're half horse. And it's true. The Tauren are physically stronger than the Centaur. Tauren could easily kill them if they could get him into hand-to-hand range. They just couldn't do it. They wouldn't fight. And it was the orcs, not the Night Elves, not anybody else. It was the orcs under Thrall who helped them. And the orcs, for all that there's lots of problems the Tauren might have with the Horde way of doing things at times, there's always been that respect between them. Even when the orcs thought everybody else in the Horde sucked, like when Garrosh was around, and Garrosh still wanted the Tauren on his side. It wasn't just for their physical power, that was certainly part of it, but even when he won the Mac-Gora, he felt bad about it. He didn't want to win that way. He respected Cairn. He was hoping Cairn would back down. That's in the book too. He's like, you know, I'll push it and he'll back down. And then Cairn was like, you don't know me at all. You think I'm gonna back down? No. Let's go. You want this to be a fight? Then it can be a fight. So no. Bane and Tauren in general are not cowards, and they're not. Bane's always been trying to reform the Horde, to get the Horde to go along with what he believes is right, because he believes it's right. It's right there in War Crimes. He defends Garrosh not because he likes him. In fact, he does not like him. He very much doesn't. If they were going to have some kind of trial combat thing, Bane would have been the first guy to fight him. Bane would have loved to have just gotten in there and beaten Garrosh to death, but he couldn't do that because it wasn't the right thing to do. He's very much about doing what the right thing to do is for his people. Right now, Sylvanas can basically say, I have evidence that you've been working with the enemy this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime she wants, she could do that. She wouldn't have to do anything. Bane would then have to decide, okay, am I going to try and lead my people against the entire Horde? Am I going to like split the Horde that I've been trying to hold together apart? Or am I going to submit and let myself be punished?
And that's the other thing that has to be considered too, that like people tend to gloss over when they ask this question, is like, Bane's not just some kid that, you know, doesn't have any responsibilities, that's running off and can go fight that village of harpies anymore because his dad was there taking care of everything and was in charge of everything. He is now in charge of them. He has to keep his people safe. He has to not worry just about what his actions are and whether or not he agrees with what's going on, but what's going to keep the Tauren safe. What is going to keep them from reprisal? Because, I mean, if you think about it right now, and we have an entire continent, more or less, that has nothing but Horde dedicated races all around it, right? What happens if he decides to withdraw from the Horde? Sylvanas could, like you said, Rossi's absolutely right. She could just go, he's been working with the Alliance the entire time. He's a sympathizer. All of the Tauren are a sympathizer. Look at them. They've been working with our enemies all along. Next thing you know, every other race of the Horde is descending upon the Tauren people. That's not a good situation to be in. That is not a situation he wants to be in. So he does what he does with, like Rossi said, he tries to reform from the inside out as opposed to open defiance.
Even if Sylvanas and the rest of the Horde didn't hold the rest of the Tauren accountable, if they just held Bane accountable all by himself, that means that the Tauren would be leaderless. And they've been leaderless once. They lost Cairn.
Well, they wouldn't be leaderless. Magatha would come and swoop in. Oh, look, you know, look, Cairn and Bane, they totally messed up. They didn't have your best intentions at heart.
But
look,
I
got
do.
Themselves killed.
Yeah.
But I can keep you safe. I have all of this power. I have nothing but the most well intentions for my people. Come worship me. Like, that's exactly what would happen. A vacuum of power, Magatha would be in charge.
And the thing is Bane knows that. He's seen that happen once before. When his father died, the Grim Totem tried to swoop in. He was there to stop them, and he did manage to stop them eventually. But if he's not there, what happens? He knows what's going to happen. So he's not going to push too hard right now. Because last time with Garrosh, you had Vol'jin, who was kind of leading the charge. And everybody else sort of, you know, formed up behind Vol'jin and helped the Darkspear with their rebellion. And that led to Garrosh being overthrown. There's no Vol'jin anymore. There's none. He's gone. He's bye-bye. And there's nobody really to form ranks with Bane. Saurfang might have, but Saurfang, as far as Bane is concerned, he got himself killed. Do you think Bane knows that Saurfang is alive?
If he does, it's surprising to me. I think it's very unlikely that he would know.
I don't think he does, because he cut all contact with Anduin.
Yeah, he had to. So yeah, right now, the only person who really knows that Saurfang is alive, at this moment, since 8.1 hasn't come out and 8.2 haven't come out yet, at this moment, the only people who know he's alive are Alliance. I guess the Horde would know because you see him.
Yeah, we have the whole breakout quest, so we know he's alive. He's just still in prison. We don't know if he's still alive.
We don't know that. Like, your player character would know, and Nathanos would know, and the other people on that mission would know.
Did Nathanos tell the rest of the Horde?
I think he probably told one person, and
Sylvanas.
She isn't telling anybody. Yeah, exactly.
Wait, wasn't Rokan with us during that whole thing?
We do not know what Rokan told anybody.
Yeah, that's true.
Rokan's telling Bane.
Sure, but I was going to say, like, Rokan seems relatively close to Bane. If anybody was going to say anything, it would be him, I think.
Yeah, but did he have time to? Because the next time you see Rokan, he's been sent off to Zandal. Rokan's on the boat with you.
Yeah.
When you end up in Zandalar.
But when you're in Zandalar,
he hasn't come back yet.
No, that's not true. Because when there are several, when you first start out as the Horde there, Talanji, Rokan, and Bane are all around the map. That is the very
that
first
means
thing
Bane's
you're interacting
come, with. Means Bane's come through. Doesn't mean Rokan's gone back. Bane might know because he'd be there to get it from Rokan, but it doesn't mean the Horde knows.
Right.
Rokan or
Talanji,
even, because Talanji's right there with Bane.
Correct.
Like, Bane actually shows up in Zandalar specifically to kind of keep an eye on things. Sylvanas tried to kind of shove him to the side, and she did in some aspects, but he's kind of back in. He's got his thumb on the pulse of things. He's not taking any direct actions right now because he can't afford to. It's not that Bane can't afford to. It's that if he does so and things fall back on his face, then he's letting down his people, and he's really unwilling to do that. And I don't think that's cowardice. That's just self-preservation.
As Joe has pointed out and as Anne has pointed out, right now, Bane is it as far as, even if he knows Saurfang's alive, Saurfang is not currently important. He'll become important when everyone knows he's outside of a prison again. But right now, the only person Bane has to fall back on is Bane and maybe Hamul. And Hamul doesn't have a lot going on right now. What with that giant gaping.
Yeah, he's got other things he's worried about. Yeah.
Yeah. As far as Hamul is concerned, well, I'm the only druid I can contact anymore because I doubt Malfurion's taken my calls. I'm kind of stuck down here. Now, the Cenarian Circle is effectively gutted right now.
Mm-hmm.
It does not have leadership anymore. The Shando is focused on something else. In a way, like, this is Sylvanas's game to lose. It's like, it comes down to, does she push things too far that other people have to act? Right now, as a Horde leader, what could Bane really say or do? It's mean that you did this thing to win a war. You know what I mean? Yeah, he may find it distasteful or even horrific, but what could he actually say? Is he going to challenge her to a Mac-Gora? She's not an orc. Is she going to accept a Mac-Gora challenge? She doesn't have to.
No, you know what I mean? Highly unlikely.
So if Bane makes a move on her, it needs to be a fatal move. And Bane is not going to just try and kill Sylvanas yet. We're not at that stage. He doesn't have the support. His own people would be like, well, are you sure about this? They're not ready to go. If the Torn aren't ready to jump, he's not going to jump. And to say that the Torn have more in common with the Alliance, why would you? That the dwarves actually dug up their ancestors' graves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's back in vanilla, guys. Dwarven explorers actually dug up Torn ancestor graves. There is no way that the Torn are going to be like, you know, super happy with the Alliance. They may not have any actual active hate with them, you know, so they don't really have any reason to, but you know, they don't have any connections there either. It's like you've on one side, you've got your friend who really helped you out of a jam once. And sometimes kind of seems like he's more trouble than he's worth. On the other side, you got that guy who watched you get beat up a lot and then broke into your garage and stole your stuff. Like, why am I going to back that guy? He stole my stuff. I don't know him.
And not only that, there's so much history now too, between the Alliance and the Horde. Let's just take in the 14 years of WoW time into effect. The Horde, the Torn have been fighting on behalf of the Horde this entire time. There's Alliance have been squashed by giant angry cow people at the behest of their leaders multiple times. They've been involved in almost every single conflict that's happened since the birth of World of Warcraft actually hit. Why would the Alliance all of a sudden say, yeah, you know what, forget it, you killed my cousin Jimmy, everything's forgiven, come on in, let's have some scones, it'll be fine,
let's like, hug it out. The thing but
that's
is
not gonna happen.
The thing is that if Anduin came to Bane and proposed some kind of peaceful solution, Bane would probably be on board with that. But would he join the Alliance? No, I don't think so. Would he be peaceful with them? Yeah, if they were going to chill and let the Torin be chill and you know, there was some kind of like simpatico sort of understanding between the two parties. Yeah, sure. But Bane's not about to sign on with the Alliance. That's not, he's not going to do
the
it.
Horde membership in a Torn Horde membership comes from a personal relationship between Cairn and Thrall. A personal moment of Thrall extending the orcs on the behalf of the Torn with no hope of a reward. It was a personal relationship that benefited both peoples, and that's where it came from. Now it's had all this time. It's not as simple as, well, they're doing bad stuff. You know, it just isn't. That's not what's going to end up happening. I think if anything, the fact that there's no backup for Bane right now is going to show exactly how circumspect his role is. He's going to have to wait for his moment.
Now that said, that his moment might be coming up soon with things that are happening, but you're absolutely right. He has to bide his time.
Yep. And that's not cowardice. That's just common sense. Anyway, thank you for the question, Halfrick. Let's go ahead and move on. We have the next email has several different questions. These are all from Norcrossus of Coralstraws, but I think what we're going to do is we're just going to go through them point by point, if that's okay with you guys.
Sure.
Okay. So the first question, did the old gods really come first, or was death there first and nobody really knew or understood it at the time? I'm not quite sure how to approach this, because the old gods were a construct created by the void, and the void was definitely there first. Well, first it was the light, and then the void, and then everything else came after that.
I think the answer is yes. I don't think there is a definitive chicken or egg here. I think they both sort of were existent at the same time, because when light and the void both came into being, it created sort of a cycle. We talked about that before, where like there's this whole life death thing going on in the entirety of the universe. So death has been there since the birth of everything, but so has the void. And the old gods are an extension of the void given manifest in the physical plane. So we don't know how many other old gods have been throughout the universe, or, you know, if the void was born and then said immediately, yep, we're going to go on that planet over there because we're just going to shotgun void goo into the material plane and see where it lands. And then that'll just be old goddy type stuff everywhere. But I think both have existed since time began.
Well, I was going to say, I'd say that the void came first. The void came first, not the old gods, the void. And I know that when void and light collided, that's kind of when life happened. That's when existence began, in that whole mashup between the two forces, if that makes sense. And at that point, that's when the void started sending out those void globules and things. So the void came first, yes, but I'm guessing that the old gods and death, and that's all tied into existence, and I think that all came into play at the same time, if that makes sense?
That's basically what I was trying to say, so yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah.
Death is something that doesn't come into existence until there are things that can die.
Yeah.
The light doesn't have that ability to die. It's the light. We don't know if Naru can actually die.
It's just a primordial force is all it is.
But the void definitely seems to be, they do not live, they do not die, they are outside the cycle. And that seems to be the case for the light as well. So I would say that death comes after the void and the light, because those things existed as universal constants. They weren't beings. I don't think you get death until you get beings.
What about the old gods, though?
The old gods come after death because there were beings before the old gods. The old gods were like, the titans exist and titans can die. So even if titans
didn't
die before that.
So you think there was death and then the old gods kind of came after that?
Yes, because the old gods were created in response to the existence of titans. Although, here's the thing. Does death exist until something has died? And had anything died before that point? Like, we know Amenthul is the first Titan that we know of that woke up. Did he have life on him? Like, so were there living things in the cosmos before the existence of the Titans? Like, that's a thing I don't know the answer
was
to.
Was he a planet with a bunch of living things crawling on him at one point in time?
For all we know, Amenthul is Earth, the planet Earth that we're on right now. Eventually it comes consciousness, becomes Amenthul, goes around the universe spreading, like, you know, Titan lore that looks an awful lot like our various mythologies, because it's kind of got them half remembered. And all the Warcraft cosmos is after Earth has turned into a giant bearded guy. I'm not saying that's what happened, but I'm saying my point being, we have no idea what Amenthul was like before he became alive, before he could talk and think. Did he have living things on him? Did those things die? I think death exists after things can die. So light and void existed first. Death would come when there were things that could die. And I think the old gods came after that. I think the old gods existed after death, but the void existed before it.
Okay.
So that would be what I would say.
Okay.
But that's just me totally death blue skying. I don't actually know.
Yeah, there's not a lot on that particular, on those technicalities, I guess, on those little fiddly bits. There's not a lot of lore involving that kind of thing, at least not yet. This all seems like something that may come into play at some point, though. Anyway, next question. Does the void really fear death as a genuine problem for everyone, or is death in a better position to take control of Azeroth, and that's what it fears?
Void doesn't fear death. Void fears undeath. Like that, or at least we think that it fears undeath. I don't think there's anything that specifically says that void fears death.
Rossi, yes, you got anything to add to that?
I'm thinking about it because I don't think Joe is wrong. I think he's right in that it was Sylvanas that the void reacted to. She serves the true enemy. And I'm thinking back to that. They do not live. They do not die. They are beyond the cycle. If you exist in a way, in way A that makes you basically capable of doing whatever the heck you want in a universe because everything in it's mortal and you can easily, you know, outlast it. What's more threatening than the concept of enemies that never die? Can't drive them mad because look at them, and you can't kill them because they're already dead, but they're still moving around.
I don't know about the driving them mad thing, because look at the Lich King.
I don't think the Lich King was crazy.
No, I don't think he was crazy at all.
In fact, I think that's part of the problem. The way that the void works, we remember we had that conversation about the whole idea of it shows you every possible thing at once and says that they're all true. But look at Sylvanas's thought processes. They don't care about options. Sylvanas does not have the capacity to think about things the way she used to. She's like pragmatism personified, and the only time you get emotional outbursts out of her is when you try to make her think like... It's when she tries to be not the cold, unfeeling monster that she starts going crazy with rage.
When you are undead, possibility isn't even a factor anymore. You just exist. That's it. And I've said this before, that Sylvanas and her people they represent stasis. They aren't on a cycle. They aren't in the cycle anymore. They are outside of the cycle, and they are neither living nor dead. They don't, the rules of existence that the void and the light are familiar with do not apply to undead creatures.
Yep, it's, they don't just, it, the laws
it's not
of
applicable.
Life.
Yeah.
That makes them a threat because now... Yeah.
Because they're an unknown. They are not a possibility. They aren't anything that the void can fathom or figure out. They aren't. We say that the void sees everything. They see every possibility, every potential, and all of them are truths, right?
But this isn't a possibility.
No, the undead are just there. They're unfathomable. They're just there.
They're not supposed to be dead and still moving.
They're unnatural.
And that's the thing. For all that the void is from outside the cycle, the last thing they want is something else from outside the cycle. Now I have to try and grok that. And Sylvanas, it's very important to watch how Sylvanas works. Every outburst of rage, every time she gets like not cold and calculating something, every time she gets angry, it's when someone tries to make her be alive. The time... Look back to War Crimes. She's at her most dangerous when she's feeling things again. Her love for her sister, she starts to feel it again, and it's agonizing. And she's like, I can't bear to lose this, but it hurts so much. I'll just kill her and make her like me, and then we'll be together forever, and I won't ever have to worry about losing her, and I won't have these feelings torturing me anymore.
I mean, heck, look at the burning of Teldrassil. That order was a knee-jerk reaction to... this other night elf who was trying to get her to show some kind of sympathy or empathy or compassion or something, some sort of signal or sign that the Sylvanas that was alive is still there and she's not. And maybe that's part of the reason why she ordered it burned, because she just wanted to prove, yeah, no, this is not a thing. This is not who I am anymore. And yeah, I think that the void is unnerved. Like I said, I think it has to do with the fact that the void sees all possibilities and everything and sees them all as truth or whatever. And undeath just doesn't fit into that anywhere. It's
right,
like this cog that's just sort of stuck in there, messing things up.
Yeah. So, I mean, to circle back to the root of the question, though, again, it's not that the void fears death. The void fears undeath. It fears stasis.
Yeah.
Completely different things.
So we're going to move on to the next question, which also makes a supposition that the void fears death. So we're going to correct that and move from there, because this is still kind of applicable anyway. The void has an incredible fear of undeath, but the light, specifically the Naru, disregard it in fear of the Legion and what Sargeras was doing. They like completely looked it over. Do you think that this might be due to how close to home the energies associated with each great threat are to the light and the void? Fel being what happens when light is destroyed and death magic being tied to the shadow. I don't think that the Naru really disregarded undeath. It's just not a priority. And
it's like, yeah, it's like when, you know, you have multiple problems happening at once. It's like, you know, there's a wild animal in my front yard that's, you know, dangerous, and that's a problem. But my house is on fire right now, and I'm standing in my burning house. I am afraid of that grizzly bear, but I'm also afraid of the house on fire that I'm standing in, and I will die if I stay here in this house. The grizzly bear might not attack me.
So let's deal with the house on fire first, and then we'll think about the other thing. And the Naru, I mean, they have worked towards that before. If you've played through the Brittenbrad storyline in Northrend, this was like the first indication that the Naru knew what was up with the undead plague and all of that, because they showed up and they intervened with Brittenbrad. He was infected with the plague, and he would have been risen as Scourge, because that's just what happens. And the Naru intervened and said, no, you're still going to die, but we're going to make sure that you go to the right place. You're not coming back as some kind of mindless undead slave. We're going to take you where you need to be. And that, I think that's the only time I've really seen them intervene in that aspect.
Which is interesting to me, too, because when you look at it, the Naru, and we just had this in the Before the Storm book, too, they seem to not really mind working with Forsaken or undeath as much, because they can still channel light. Like, we have priests that they work with that, you know, channel the light at great cost to their own person, whatever. But they don't seem to really care about that as much because, okay, you're still doing light things. You're okay. We can deal
with
you.
Here's the thing to think about. The light has imposed the cycle on itself.
Yeah.
The shadow, the void has not. They do not live. They do not die. They are outside the cycle. The light, we're like, okay, we'll be in this. If in order to be in this universe, we will accept a cyclical existence. We will have Naru that have light and dark cycles. The void does not. And we've always seen that, and we've never really thought about how come the void doesn't have this limitation that the light does? Why would the light accept such a limitation? Because you have to accept such a limitation to work in this universe, and that's always been the void's greatest advantage. But what if it's also their greatest weakness?
It's kind of weird, too, because the void, like we said, it sees all possibilities as truth, whereas the light picked one and sees that as like the irrevocable truth of all existence and all things. Yet the light has shown that it's way more flexible in terms of fitting into. And maybe that's part of it too, is that the light and the creatures of the light, they're willing to adapt to the cycle because they see the cycle as the one truth. Yeah?
Yeah, it could entirely be possible. I mean, if you look at like...
Most likely, actually.
If you look at Lothraxian... Or if you look at like the light bound, I was thinking about this the other day. I wrote about it to a little degree. The thing is that both the Maghar and the light bound can be correct in their view that you know the other is to blame for what's happening to Draenor, because both are operating from a different perspective, and that's the problem the light has is the light only sees the one perspective. But what if the problem with the void is that it does not understand that there can be perspectives it does not see? The light knows that there are perspectives it does not see. It just doesn't think they're true. But the void can't believe it doesn't see everything. And if there is something out there now that they don't understand,
like the undead,
they can't cope with it because they cannot believe that it is what it is.
Yeah,
it's got to be something else because it can't be this thing, because if it was that thing, it would be something we saw and we don't see it.
And what did the light do when confronted with undeath?
It tried to make its own. Look at what happens with Kalia.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, well, just, you can still be that thing as long as you come to our understanding. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
We don't care what you are. We just care that eventually you embrace our view of the universe.
I feel like Kalia was like the attempt to bring undeath within the cycle, maybe to a degree.
I'm not sure.
Well, I think we have to wait and see how that pans out before we can really make that statement. But yeah.
It certainly seems to be the light, basically, the light has shown a few times now that it does not reject the undead. And that comes back to something Velen once said. Do you guys remember? Oh, bloody heck. It's in the Swamp of Sorrows. The guy's dying.
Yeah.
And he can't be saved.
Yeah.
And Velen shows up. Velen shows right up and says, the light does not abandon its champions, but it does not operate unopposed in this world's realm.
Yeah.
The light... It would help you. It just can't. Now, sometimes the light's help is, I'm going to make you into a being of perfect light and understanding. I don't want to be a being of light and perfect understanding. Huh?
That's where free will comes into play, yeah. And it's very puzzling.
You don't want it?
How can you not want it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think we've, like, that's the problem with the light right now is we've moved into, like, thinking that they're sinister, but they're not. The problem with the light is that it doesn't get the idea of looking at it a different way. Sure, you're undead, but of course you want to be one of us, like, you know, being a perfect light and perfect understanding. No? Huh.
Well, that's weird.
Okay, I'm going to say this again. Okay, Illidan, I'm going to try this again. I'm going to fix all your problems and make you a being of perfect understanding. I don't want it. What did he say? I'm going to do it. That's the problem with Zera. She didn't know what to do with the no. Do you know what I mean? Like, the same way she was with Ilaria.
It's kind of what Algolon demonstrated when you ran into Algolon and you defeated him. He said perhaps it's that free will that makes you different from everything else. Because he couldn't comprehend it either. It was one of those things where it was like, has everything loved life the way that you do? Because I don't get that. Like, that's weird. And if that's the case, then that means that all of these other worlds that I've seen perish or be, you know, reoriginated, there were things like you there. I did that. I want Algolon to come back at some point, because supposedly he's just been observing Like, that's he left after Ulduar and left to go observe the world and observe these weird creatures. And I would love for him to show up again and start talking about what he decided or what he found. I don't know. It's one of those things that I'm like, I would like that. Anyway, okay, moving on. There's one last question here from Norcrosis, who says, are the old gods the Titan-sized equivalent of the mind control thing that Aranok Stonespeaker had on his head in Throne of the Tides? Does whoever make it to Azeroth's brain first get to be the pilot? Thanks for all of your watching, Norcrosis. So, yeah, that's actually kind of funny, because I went to, where did I go to? Deadwatch. I went to Deadwatch today for a world quest thing that I, or no, an achievement that I was knocking out. And there was a world quest there that had those little purple dudes that ride around on your head, the thing, the mindbender thing that Aranok Stonespeaker had on in Throne of the Tides. So I was like, oh, wow, that's convenient. So yeah, are the old gods the equivalent, like the giant equivalent of those little brain sucker thingies?
I think, too, that's not a bad analogy. The old gods seem to be macro scale viruses, like they're infections on a reality level, like literally like giant germs thrown into our universe from another cosmos. And the way that they operate seems to be like the Naraki and the Akir were literally born from their bodies. And it feels an awful lot like they're just fractal, like up and down. It's all the same thing. It's the same kind of thing. It's a twisted abomination type thing that uses this universe as the raw material to make more of itself to try and infect and overwhelm a host. The way, if you get a virus, that's what it does inside you. It uses you to make more of it. And it's kind of how the old gods seem to operate. And the little ones are just smaller versions. So, yeah, I think that's not a bad analogy for them. I don't know if it's exactly one-to-one, but it does feel like it hits to the truth of them. The way that they work.
Yeah, I mean, I would go a little bit maybe different, where I wouldn't say that necessarily the first one that gets there gets to be the pilot. I think it's more of a corruption sort of mechanic as far as that goes.
Yeah, I don't think it would be like, driven around by...
Yeah, it's not like a Megazord or something.
Yeah, I don't think Yashraj is going to be perched on it, on the face of it, going, yeah, driving it. But I think that...
And I'll form the head. No.
The old gods themselves would probably not exist anymore.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. They would sacrifice.
It'd be like if the viruses kill the host dies. In this case, the virus would turn the host into a huge breeding ground, the Void Titan that would then corrupt our entire universe. But yeah, I don't think they'd actually be riding around on their face. But it's still a decent analogy for how they operate.
It'd be existence's worst Voltron ever. Okay, so that wraps up Necrosis. I have one more email here. This is a lengthy one, but I think it's worth discussing, just because we never seem to tire of talking about Sylvanas, so why not? This one is from Persky, who's a gnome mage on Wormrest Accord, who says, "Oh, Watchers of Lore, I had what I hope to be an original thought regarding Sylvanas' motivations in the burning of Teldrassil. I've previously had a hard time reconciling Sylvanas' reputation as a peerless tactician, particularly given her recent decisions. However, a thought struck me regarding her ultimate strategic aims for the unfolding war. As she tells Nathanos, her ultimate goal is to take Stormwind and raise its population into the Forsaken, something she would know that the orcs, tauren, trolls, etc. would not agree with. So she forces the issue by committing an atrocity so grievous it causes the breakout of total war on Azeroth, a conflict in which peace between the factions is not, she hopes, an option. She tells Horde leaders that the attack on Teldrassil is meant to deny the Alliance a port for the shipment of Azerite. However, all along she intends to burn the tree, uniting the Alliance against the Horde. The Horde now has no choice but to follow Sylvanas into this war for survival. Of course, I could be wrong, and her decisions are solely driven by the amount of mustache, or in her case, eyebrow twirling, she can do afterwards, and the demand of plot-driving character rather than the other way around. I hope this message finds you all well, and that what I've said makes some kind of sense. Cheers, Persky."
That actually has something to it that I've been thinking about myself a little bit, too.
Yeah.
Which is, Sylvanas has commented multiple times through the various different forms of media that we've gotten that, what reason does the Horde have to follow me? I'm paraphrasing, but it's more dramatic and well written than that, as far as what I'm saying, than what I'm saying. But it's like, they could turn on me at any second. I'm not really one of them. You know, and then she just has this thing too, where if you look at, again, before the storm, her own people, the ones that are supposed to be wholly devoted to her, are going to leave to go to be with their Alliance family. Like, she understands that this is a possibility after this.
And what's her response to that?
She goes and murders them. She destroys them. She burns everything essentially from the ground up.
She ushers them into that final death that they were looking forward to so much, because so she knows what's beyond it.
But and this would make good sense in that. Because if her own people, the ones that are supposed to be so beholden to her, are willing to turn their backs on her, then what do the other races in the Horde have to really lock them under her? So I could see that being the thing where she's not necessarily doing it for any other reason aside from taking the option of peace away. Because
there's actually one other reason that you're missing.
Oh?
Gonna have to get a little into spoilers on 8.1 to talk about it, but it's coming out in a week and we're all gonna see it.
Like, okay, so let's just real quick here. Spoiler warning.
I was trying
for
real hard to avoid 8.1.
Spoiler warning for 8.1. If you haven't played through the content yet, if you're listening to this on Patreon, if you're listening to this on the website, 8.1 has been out for a week. What have you been doing? Anyway, spoiler warning for plot elements, and let's go ahead and go. Okay, Rossi, spill it.
We find out in 8.1, we find out that Sylvanas can make Dark Rangers out of Night Elves.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that means the Night Elves that she's killing can swell her ranks. And she's an elf. And the Dark Rangers have always been more loyal to her than anybody else. And if she can turn the Caldari, in a way, it's a reunion of her people. In death, they're her people again. She can create a new kind of Forsaken that are even more like her, and much more likely to support her. And it's very clear to me that she does something that twists their worldview. You can tell me all you want that she doesn't control them and doesn't break their will, but I'm sorry, she can make them turn on their own people immediately. So she's doing something.
There's a couple of things here that I want to point out. And one of them I brought up in the Know Your Lore that I wrote last week. For people who think that this viewpoint of Sylvanas wanting to swell the ranks of the Forsaken and all of this is a relatively new development, it's not. It's been there since vanilla. It's been there since, like, the first handful of quests that you played as a brand new Forsaken. The reason Sylvanas orders... The reason that Sylvanas orders the development of the Forsaken Blight, the reason that she orders the development of the Blight, there's two reasons to it. First off, it's designed and engineered to wipe out the Scourge because she wants to stick it to the Lich King. And that's been her MO ever since she broke free of his control. The second reason, and it was something that was in development and not quite working the way that she wanted it to, was that it would murder the living Alliance or whoever and immediately raise them not as Scourge, but as Forsaken. It would murder the Scourge and raise them, not as Scourge, but Forsaken. It was being engineered, or trying to be engineered, to bolster her ranks.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets used at the Wrathgate, and Putrest yells, death to the Scourge and death to the living, that's not a surprise.
No.
That's what the plague was always made to do.
It's what it's always been engineered to do. It's why she made the Royal Apothecary Society.
The only thing Putrus did that wasn't what she wanted was he made a deal with
Varimothras
to take over the Undercity. That
and if
wasn't
you think
her idea.
That Sylvanas didn't know about that, I don't know. I think that Varimothras was never on her side.
Obviously.
He's an agent of the Burning Legion. Of course he's going to be working behind her back. Of course he's going to be doing all this other stuff. She's keeping an eye on him. She's smart. She's always been brilliant, tactically brilliant.
Plus, there's always the fact that it's better to know where the knife is coming from. Like, she got out of Undercity real fast.
What I pointed out in the Know Your Lore that I wrote is that in that whole battle for the Undercity, we never found out what triggered that rebellion, what triggered Varimothras to choose that point in time. We never figure it out. Because as players, as Horde players, you are sent to Orgrimmar and you talk to Thrall. And Thrall has just had a conversation with who? Sylvanas Windrunner. And Sylvanas tells him, they turned against me and I barely escaped with my life. And does he believe her? Yes, absolutely. Because by all appearances, that's exactly what happened. But I'm wondering, and what I hypothesize in that Know Your Lore is this something that she initiated? Did she nudge him into reacting? Did she nudge him into starting this whole coup attempt because what happened at the Wrathgate went belly up and didn't happen the way it was supposed to?
Entirely possible. I mean, also very probable that she doesn't strike me as a creature that gets caught unawares often, if ever.
No, but I mean, here's what Battle for the Undercity did. Got rid of Verimothras, who she knew was already working against her. Got rid of Putress, who was the one person, or one of a handful of Forsaken, who could say, Sylvanas ordered that attack on the Wrathgate. What are you talking about? I wasn't working on my own. She told me to do it. But she got rid of him. And she got rid of all of the people that were working with him. And it presented her in something almost unfathomable. It presented her in a sympathetic light, where the rest of the Horde was like, oh, poor Sylvanas, she barely escaped. Oh my gosh, her people are working against her. This is terrible. We need to help her. And then she could just slide under the radar. And the only person who suspected anything or pointed out anything was Garrosh. And what happened to him?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think Sylvanas was so gung-ho about joining the Rebellion? Why not get rid of that one guy who suspects that anything weird is going on?
Well,
she's
brilliant.
She is absolutely brilliant.
and you gotta also consider the fact that she was probably planning that for a while, especially with Garrosh as well.
Absolutely.
Simply because, I mean, if you do any of the early Forsaken questing, even now, like, he's sending agents to watch her. That was the whole thing.
Yeah, he had the Corcron replace the Undercity guards so they could keep an eye on her. He was suspicious, like, right from the get-go. And he was the only one, really, that was... And what did everybody do? Oh, poor Sylvanas, she's got the Corcron breathing down her neck. Ooh, Garrosh is such a jerk. But the thing is Garrosh may have been a jerk, but he had a point.
He wasn't wrong.
No, he was not wrong. What happened in Gilneas? They ordered Sylvanas, do not unleash the Blight. And then they walked out. And what did she do immediately after the general walked out? Said, of course we're going to unleash the Blight. What are you thinking? So, I mean, there's a lot going on here as far as her plans. And I feel like this theory that Persky mentioned as far as forcing the issue, it's not entirely out of place, because I don't think that she really... The role of War Chief, I don't think it's something that she cares about. I don't think she cares about the Horde so much as far as, like, the living members of the Horde.
No, I do think, though, that there is something to be considered here.
Yeah?
It's like, when you get on a tiger's back, you can't just get off.
No.
Mm-hmm.
The old saying. The Horde is dangerous. Look at what they can do militarily.
Well, we just talked about that with Bane. It would be the same thing reversed.
She's in charge right now. But the second she's not in charge, the next War Chief is probably going to want to talk to her.
And if that next War Chief happens to be somebody like Bane.
Yeah, Bane or Sorfang are her nightmare scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, even if somehow through, like, I don't know how this would possibly happen, but let's assume for a moment that, like, we got a Blood Elf War Chief.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Lorthamar is still under her thumb.
Not if he's War Chief.
Exactly. Mm. He has...
Right now, I don't think he's under her thumb. I think he's basically playing the same game as Bane, just he's playing it longer, and he's better at it. He knows exactly how to be ingratiating with her, because he knew her.
Yep. You know,
and she's different now, but he remembers, he can assume that mask of, you know, you're the head of the Rangers and I'm your lieutenant. Tell me what you want me to do and I'll do it. He can assume that air with her and she's willing to accept it from him. There's a little bit of that there, and they're both more, you know, Bane, for all that he's very smart.
It's little Bane residual not, echoes of who she used to be.
Well, Bane's not sophisticated in the way that Lorthamar is.
I was going to say, if anybody could match her in deviousness and like spy network, I would put it on Lorthamar that he could. So like, if anybody has a chance of like finding the spies or the eyes and ears that she sends out as much as like he's probably doing to her, it's probably him. So yeah, I don't think he's as under her thumb as we think he is. I think he knows
how she operates. He does know how she operates. Yeah. And when I say that he's under her thumb, I mean that, what was it? In the Shadows of the Sun, I think that was the short story where she came to him and said, I need you to send people to Northrend, like right after everything had happened with the Sunwell and everything else. And he's like, I don't have the people to spare. And she said, I got you into the Horde. You owe me. Find your people, send them north. And that was the end of that. And he knew that there was no arguing with that.
Sure.
Yeah, but
now
that was before the South became full of Alliance soldiers.
That's true.
And she does not have control of Lordaeron anymore. She is not a direct existential threat to him. She
not only that.
Threat, but she's not that direct existential threat she once was.
Do you think the Horde would actually accept Lorthamar as a leader?
I think they would.
I don't think so yet. I think that stuff would have to happen. Lorthamar would have to do things that would put him in that position. Like, I think Sorfang or Bane are much, much more likely candidates than Lorthamar.
Sure.
And she knows it. She's systematically taking them out. Yeah. She's been pushing Sourfang's buttons and keeping him on the edge of, I don't know if I want to be here or not. And as long as he's been playing nice, she's been tolerating him. But as soon as he stopped playing nice, she made the moves to get him out of there with a few well-placed words about his son, which was so grossly just, ugh, that whole moment. That whole moment at the Battle for Lordaeron just really made me cringe. But then you go one step beyond that, right? And you go to the Horde cinematic at the end of the Battle for Lordaeron when Bane turns around and he says, you left him to die. And she says, you can join him if you like. And she's deliberately trying to push his buttons. She's trying to get Bane to fly off the handle, because the moment that he does, she's got him right where she wants him, and she can take him out. And if the Tauren don't have a leader in place, either A, M'Gatha swoops in and takes over, or B, all of a sudden they're all under Sylvanas because they've got nobody else to look to, so they might as well look to the War Chief.
Well, going back to the Lorthamar thing real quick, too, there's another thing that we haven't mentioned that I think is kind of important. Yes, Sylvanas had that thing where I got you into the Horde, you owe me. Who did Lorthamar bring into the Horde recently that's an allied race that's kind of important?
Oh, yeah.
That has all sorts of arcane, you know, prowess and controls basically all of the Horde's portals now.
Well, and I think he brought them in kind of on purpose. Like,
yep.
I think part of the reason why the Blood Elves were so ingratiating and adamant about their outreach to the Nightborn was because it was like, let's bring you in, because then we will have at least one pal on our side that we absolutely know about who is closer to the Eastern Kingdoms than Kalimdor and can back us up in a fight.
Well, not only that, but like, let's say we have to get the heck out of Dodge real quick. Having, you know, Oculeth and his
you guys totally know how to get out of trouble.
I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of this expansion there were suddenly, I don't think this will happen, but it wouldn't shock me if the Blood Elves have to evacuate to Suramar.
Yeah, I would actually be okay with surprise. That
because right now they are in a bad position.
Yep. Between undead and trolls and still half a dead city.
Yeah. They're the only Horde city left on their Eastern Kingdoms.
I mean, and the Alliance have that with the Draenei, but the Draenei,
at least they're an island.
They can't fly that ship, but I would not be shocked if they could initiate its weapon systems.
Yeah, it's functional.
Well, not only that, but they're an island. There's limited ways that people can get to them, and I don't think anybody's going to try to. It would be really weird to see somebody try to out-magic the Draenei. Like, it really would be something.
I think it's possible possibly to out arcane magic them, because they haven't necessarily kept up on it to the degree that they once were.
Sure. But if the Nightborn are like, the
sheer amount of light that they can pull through,
mm-hmm.
like Divinus isn't a joke, and neither is Velen for that matter. Velen, we saw what the alternate universe Velen could do. He could step into a dark Naru and just, boom, turn it back. It tossed him his life, but that's a lot of power. That's a lot of power. And that's just, you know, imagine an angry Velen defending his people. We've seen that he's not the guy he was anymore. He's much more active than he used to be.
Yeah.
I would not want to push him into a role where he feels like, oh, you're coming. The Horde is coming to attack my people again, is it? Well, we're not running this time. You know, and again, there's that ship up in orbit. And we haven't seen that.
The
main
Vendigar
gun
could do some serious damage.
I think right now Velen is keeping his people out and keeping they're a place where the Alliance forces can go. They can retreat, like Night Elves have retreated to that island and so forth, but you don't want to push him. Like right now Sylvanas does not have the means to push him. So we'll see what happens.
Okay. Well, I think we're gonna go ahead and wrap it up here. Thank you, Persky, for the email. I don't know if we addressed your theory specifically, but I think we did pretty good with it anyway, as far as going on a tangent. Just as a reminder for you guys, the listeners of Blizzard Watch, Audible's offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service before the storm. I know we've talked about it a lot already throughout the show. It's one of those audiobooks that you can use or that you can choose with your free 30-day trial if you want to. That one is narrated by Josh Keaton, who also does the voice of Anduin Wrynn in-game. So it's kind of a unique experience because it's like Anduin's reading the book to you, and it's very well done. You can download that, or there's a bunch of other Blizzard titles that are available. Or if you don't have any interest in Blizzard titles at all, there's thousands of other books that you can choose from. And you can do that by going to blizzardwatch.com/audible. Every sign up helps support the show and everything that we do. Blizzard Watch, it's made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. And your continued support means that this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on a podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. Final thoughts, you guys. I'm going to go back to her because we just kind of touched on her very briefly, but with 8.1 coming out next week and with the limited knowledge that we have of patches that are coming up, Kalia Menethil, when do you think we'll see her again and in what capacity? Joe?
Towards the end of the expansion and probably during the overthrow of Sylvanas. Or redemption of Sylvanas, whatever happens with Sylvanas. So whenever we start getting to the climactic moment that deals with her and the things that she's doing, that's when we're going to start to see Kalia again.
Okay, Rossi, same question.
We know she gets mentioned by Jaina in 8.1. Jaina asks Anduin about her. I don't think she'll be in 8.2 because 8.2 is not focused on the Horde Alliance conflict. So that puts her in 8.3, in my opinion.
And how do you think that she'll fit in?
That's a good question, but the fact that Jaina is asking about her implies to me that Jaina wants to reach out to her. I think it's going to be, we know what the Horde is doing, and I don't know about spoiling, but the Horde is doing something with someone that would hurt Jaina. I think Jaina is thinking in a similar way, and she's going to reach out to Kalia because it could hurt Sylvanas. So probably as a secret weapon to use against Sylvanas.
So, in other words, yeah, we're probably going to see her at some point in the future. I can't see them dropping that plot point, that really big plot point at the end of Before the Storm, and not utilizing it in the expansion in some capacity. So
I could see them doing that because they've done that before, but then they have her get mentioned in the game.
Yeah.
And that, once you've got Jaina actually asking about her in-game, then I start to pay attention.
That's when you go, yeah, that's probably going to come into play at some point here. All right. Well, anyway, thank you guys very much for listening, as always, and we will see you again in 2 weeks.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.